This is Mouth Media Network. Amplify and connect.
I'm Natalie Mackey. I'm the CEO of Winky Lux. And what I love about beauty is the community that comes together around the products and all of the connections that are made.
It started with a happy accident, a tech platform experiment gone bad, and turned into a viral makeup brand that struck gold by responding quickly to consumer needs and wants. The secret sauce? Delivering luxury for less. Being nimble at developing around customer-driven trends, moving from direct-to-consumer to retail, e-commerce isn't necessarily king, and the ethos of bringing moments of joy into every day.
From New York City, you're listening to Beauty is Your Business, covering the intersection of innovation and business in the beauty industry.
Welcome to Beauty is Your Business. This is Karen Moon. I'm joined by April Franzino.
Hi, Karen. Hi. Happy to be here.
So we're so excited to have you on the show. You've been getting a ton of buzz with the business. Tell us a little bit more about Winky Lux and just the business overall, because it's part of a Glow concept, right? What's
correct.
Tell us what the vision for what you're doing is and how that's evolving.
Sure. So Glow Concept is a house of brands. We actually have Lacca & Co., Winky Lux, and Beautiful Rights, which is a charitable initiative. But Winky Lux is really the star of the show. So sometimes it's a little bit misleading, but I'm the CEO of Glow Concept, but I spend probably 95% of my time on Winky Lux. It seems to be the only thing people want to talk about lately. So that is mostly how I just identify it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's been really fun. It's been a very fast growing brand and I've been very lucky. Like, it's great.
So how did you end up in this position? And tell us a little bit about the fast growth and how that happened.
So we launched 4.5 years ago, almost exactly. And we really felt like there was a lot of room for improvement on the beauty supply chain, not necessarily in the way that the product was made at the lab or the way it was filled at the filler or the factory, but there was a really big break in the way that decisions were made internally, and or we felt in the industry there was a break in that, and there was a way to make decisions quicker, speak to the suppliers faster, and use better technology to create products much more quickly. So, and also there was so much real-time data for the first time in the industry. So there was we were seeing this movement kind of happen in fashion. And I think we became known as sort of like a fast-to-market brand. So we put a big emphasis, it's our third core tenet of the company, is that we have a bias towards speed. So a lot of what we think about is how to create really amazing products with cleaner ingredients that have real efficacy that are, which we believe like the cleaner ingredient story is almost table stakes at this point, but the real efficacy is another thing that I can kind of dive into later around like why certain things don't take as long as they sort of industry-wide are perceived to take. And that's kind of how we grew the business in an inventory light way, in a way that was really working capital efficient. And then Winky Lux itself is just about joy and about having a really fun moment with something, having a moment in your day that is really about treating yourself. So it really comes from that treat yourself culture.
So when you talk about speed, especially in beauty, what are the time frames traditionally and how much faster are you doing them, but also maintaining, you know, testing, you know, how do you, it's a little bit more complicated, right? How do you solve, crack that?
So particularly as the business has grown and we have brought on much bigger retail partnerships, we've started to – so this is kind of a twofold. I can get like very convoluted when I'm talking about this because there's so many moving parts. But start –
but it's fascinating because I'd have to say like speed to market is one of the top – if you – I think CUW did a survey and for a lot of executives, speed to market was one of the initiatives that they were very interested in. It's obviously easier said than done in this industry.
Yeah. I think the way that we looked at it, we had an advantage by being new. Mm-hmm. And both my business partner and I had come from different industries. I had worked peripherally with the beauty industry. So I knew enough about manufacturing probably to be dangerous. But we knew that the actual part of the manufacturing process, and every product developer knows this, is not really the long part. It's really an organizational break. Mm-hmm. So as we've started to grow, we've had the challenge of working with our retailer timelines, mm-hmm. which has totally changed. We were born online, so we had the benefit of being able to launch, test, pivot the way a tech company would, so we could get a product out. We would see what the initial reaction was. And then if we really believed in it, we would go much, much bigger. We would start to edit it. We'd start to make it, get it down to a better cost of good, just like better product and bigger. That said, now that we started to grow, we've really split our supply chain into two factions. One is the group that works on products that are very fast to market. And they're doing a lot of they're holding hands with the consumer insights team all the time. They're keeping packaging on hand. We also have a really unusual relationship with some of our packaging suppliers in that we've helped them build out a lot of their portfolio, and we've been able to do really, really quick time to market there.
It's almost like you could be a test for them on how to do speed with other people, right?
Totally. And yeah. I think they weren't a newer factory, but they were newer in the packaging game for beauty. They weren't newer in the packaging game for other CPG products. But it was very helpful to have that kind of deep partnership. They could do things much faster, and they were willing to kind of step into the new world with us. And I think that's been really beneficial for them too, is to have that emphasis on speed. Every product developer will tell you that packaging is like the bane of their existence and is always a huge issue. It always seems to take, a ton of time. The actual product production, making the product, testing the product, is not really that time consuming. You're looking at 3 to 6 months for compatibility testing, some of which can be obfuscated if it's a product that we're testing and getting out into the market. Now, that I think a lot of times there's a confusion between compatibility testing and batch testing. Those are two different things. And a lot of times the consumer gets confused about what's what. So batch testing is the law and it's required and it's for safety. And so, of course, everything has to be tested in that way. But as far as a compatibility test, like for a lip gloss, for instance, your business risk in launching, let's say, a lip gloss and not doing a compatibility test on a PPT component is that you might have splitting in the lip gloss. Now, then you might have to recall, let's say, 5,000 lip glosses. It's rare because your product development team should be smart enough that they should really have a good idea. If you have a real chemist on the team and you're really working with great labs, you should already have a pretty good idea of what will work and what won't. Of course, there's always some risk that it won't, but the risk of losing the trend, we believe, is much bigger. So knock on wood, we've never had to recall anything for that type of thing. Now, I'm sure that it could happen at some point. Now, when we get into skincare and skincare hybrids, we have a longer lead time. Sunscreen, that's an FDA, that's a...
It's much more complicated.
Yeah, that's a drug. So that is completely... We have to follow every single step there, but where we really have an advantage in products like that is that we make decisions very quickly. And we have built customer insights into that supply chain. So as the product's being developed, we're getting those customer insights in real time, as opposed to waiting for it to be an almost finished prototype and doing a 12-person focus group.
Tell us about kind of taking a step back for listeners. You're taking a much more modern approach to everything you do. Like, tell us about the ethos of the Winky Lux brand, what you saw, and like, did that change at all with consumer insights and like how's that been evolving?
Sure. So the brand itself, we call ourselves a consumer insights OG. We began as a tech platform. My business partner and I were building a tech platform. And the idea was it was going to be a curation software and operate as a marketplace. So we started to wireframe this thing out. We built a really clunky beta version of it. And we decided to do like a very in-depth focus group to really hone in on what UX and UI would look like for this customer. So we interviewed almost 200 women between 16 and 29. And this was the smartest thing we ever did. And I think that, you know, we've made plenty of mistakes, but one thing I think we've always had built into the company is this great notion of asking the customer. So we did this big focus group. We kept asking her, And what we found is she didn't care about the tech platform and that she really – it was a much bigger problem. It wasn't that she thought, oh, this could be easier to use. She just didn't feel like this particular thing was of use to her. So that was good news that we hadn't spent any more money on that. But the other thing that we started to see, which was sort of like a happy accident, was we realized that she – one of the things that we'd started working on before – let me backtrack for a second. Before we started to do this insight, we knew that for marketplaces to really be profitable, you need at least one private label brand within the marketplace. So we'd started to kind of play around with this idea of a really unique and really happy brand that would kind of stand out and would be very accessibly priced. And so the idea was that that and it was more of like almost an afterthought. But as we started to ask these women, and it was a little bit biased towards college-age women because of the way that we were recruiting. I had a cousin in college who's in a sorority, and I asked her to get all of her friends together. And then they started telling their friends, and we were giving them a free lip gloss. So you'd be amazed at how much people, how much time people will commit for a free lip gloss. They'll sit with you for hours. But it was a really fun and like enlightening process. So she, this consumer, we were asking her to dump out her makeup bag. We were asking her why she purchased different products. And one of the things that was a tell that we weren't leading her on was she kept doing – she had like an apologetic tone for a lot of her drugstore products. So she would say things that were very telling, like, oh, I just bought that because I ran out of my good stuff. Or you should try that. It's actually really good even though it came from the drugstore. So like I said, we knew enough about the manufacturing process to know that there was a lot of overlap in quality between those two industries, mass and prestige. And so we were curious as to why she didn't feel great about buying this $5 eyeliner when the quality and efficacy was really, really similar to the more luxurious one. And eyeliner is a really great example because there's like three manufacturers and they – like a lot of eyeliners are very similar in quality and efficacy. So it was fascinating to us, like, how come nobody's really cracked this code? And why is it that everything that's at this price point is so basic looking? Like, why does it all have every piece of product knowledge script? And I know that there are business reasons why, but it seemed that some of those marketing decisions made sense from an operational standpoint, but not from a customer experience standpoint. So the customer wanted beautiful, metalized, luxurious looking and feeling, sparkly, shiny product that almost felt like jewelry. She really wanted something precious. The word precious has like a bad connotation, but she wanted something that felt valuable. And there's a lot of ways you can create a beautiful, valuable product at a good price. So we kind of set out to do that. And then WinkyLux was so different in it. We had so much permission because it was going to be an afterthought. We had a lot of permission to be really weird and wild with it. So it became very hot pink, very floral, very – I guess the word is like extra – so it became like, and it was right at a moment where there was a big emphasis on crisp, austere branding. So you had kind of like what I call like the Allbirds movement, where everything started to be like very clean, very minimalist. And so I think we had a moment to like really stand out and be certainly to look different on the internet. And that's how the brand got started.
And so it was really the first product. Was it the first product The lip that was the, or was it
the
just
flower bomb?
The one that
that sort was the of, first viral product.
Yeah. Speaking of packaging and things that, you know, were really eye catching and stand out, like to me, that's an example of something that I, you know, I that's how I identify the brand. I basically think of them because based on that product, which I'm sure a lot of people do.
Yeah. We sell like one a minute or something crazy. Still. I think it's really interesting because we – maybe I'm just not like great at trend projection. Like maybe there are groups of people that are just so much better at like saying this is what's going to be hot. But for us, it's always been like the consumer has always told us what's hot. Mm-hmm. So – our first products were a matte lipstick that came in a pill-shaped form that was kind of inspired by this Damien Hirst, like, pill moment where he did all of these cool silver and gold pills. And the idea of, like, beauty being this kind of healthy addiction and, you know, like how people just really felt about it. And so that was the inspiration for that. But we launched that, and we launched a foundation powder that had crushed diamonds in it, which was kind of a – it was a really high-end raw ingredient that you don't need a lot of to create like this illumination. And so you'll see it in like really, really expensive skincare. Mm-hmm. And so we started putting it into our foundation product. And that we got like some good – some traction there. But it was nothing like the Flower Balm. And the Flower Balm was next. And that was a product that we had been seeing in Korea. Like versions of this had we've been seeing in like Korean beauty. And so we kind of – reverse engineered this with a real flower, with no parabens, with like a much cleaner supply chain.
I didn't know
chain.
That they were real.
They're real flowers.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, they're baby chrysanthemums. They're growing in Brazil. They're like, I think we probably like this. We might be the largest buyer of baby chrysanthemums. It's like a weird claim to fame, but they're real flowers. And then that, it was like a moment in time too, where I think, you know, the Instagram was really at a fever pitch for beauty, and it just went totally viral. And so it became our best-selling product. It still is our best-selling product. It's definitely a much smaller percentage of the overall sales, but it is like – it's still the number one single SKU. And people still really love it. And I think the brand has like become synonymous with it. And we always had this floral theme, so.
What do you think – what was it about that specific product that really like – you know, made it such a runaway hit?
I think people really love beautiful things. The blooming pigment is very fun. The pigment mm-hmm. that breaks when it touches your skin. So it's very customizable because it looks different on everyone. So I think that that's a really great thing to sell as a digitally, like an e-commerce company, right? Mm-hmm. Because there's no shade matching. There's no concern that it's going to be.
It's not going to look good on you. Basically.
Totally. Yeah.
I wonder if it's also like the element of curiosity.
Totally.
You know, like if you think about the tenets of what goes viral, it's like transformation and like being able to see something and experience it. Totally. Like it's kind of interesting.
And interactive with your friends. We have like people and YouTubers who would do videos with it with their friends. And they'd say like, oh, your pink looks different than mine. And then I think there's just a – like how we can't ever have enough pretty things in our lives, right? Like there's so – I think we always want like very beautiful things that inspire us visually, and that was such a pretty, beautiful product. And we were so proud to be able to create it in a way that, you know, was safer and was really accessible.
There's really nothing like it on the market here, you know, at the time for sure. So I think it just stood out.
Yeah. Cool. And they had been making those. I mean, they had been putting little flowers and things. Back in the 90s, there was a company that did it in like lip glosses. Mm-hmm. And I think there's also an element of nostalgia for that too. Mm-hmm. Like I'm 35, so in the 90s when I had like a caboodle and
– oh, my God, caboodles.
Oh, yes, love caboodles.
So there was something like a little bit nostalgic about having a
someone should bring those back.
I think they're still around.
Yeah, they are.
I want to do a
and the Trapper Keeper.
Yes.
Oh my God, that'd be hilarious.
Amazing. Lisa Frank. Like the 90s were fantastic.
Oh, Lisa Frank's still around.
Oh yeah, I
girls of this generation, like the next generations now, my sister's daughter-in-law, she is like obsessed with Lisa Frank. I'm like, it continues. Awesome. It just makes me feel, it's like you said, the nostalgia thing. It's like everything comes back like a cycle. Yeah. So that's so cool. I just had to, I was like, you know, that is such, it's become sort of an iconic product over the past couple of years of like this era, which is really cool.
Yeah.
To have that as like your brand marquee, which is really neat.
I can't wait to like learn more about like where you're going to take it. So it's so interesting, like the evolution of it, and you're doing things differently. But before we do that, let's break for snack time. It's when on the show where we get to what we call break bread, but like really like just share and hear a different side of you. So what did you decide to choose today?
So
and I know there was a little bit of a last minute mishap, but it actually all worked out really well.
So I chose Rice Krispies Treats because of the nostalgia. Uh-huh. And then I walked out of the office and I had two bags. I had to remember one had the pack of Rice Krispies Treats and one had a pack of products, and I just grabbed the products and walked out. So luckily there was a Starbucks on the corner where they also sell, I think, even the fancier version of Rice Krispies Treats.
Oh my God, these are so good.
But I think they don't get credit for being an elegant enough snack. They're so fun.
And they're so delicious.
And they're so good.
I feel like there's this theme of like joyfulness.
Yes. Yes, Rice Krispies are like the Winky Lux of snacks.
That is the ultimate compliment.
I see it. I see this energy.
Thank you.
Entreprenista, a woman who organizes and operates a business, taking on greater than normal financial risks in order to do so.
One who has a drive, passion, and vision with an undying determination to succeed.
She is fiercely motivated, ambitious, and competitive, forging her own path to independence and success.
That's an entreprenista.
Through the conversations on the Entreprenista podcast, we want to celebrate failures, reflect on successes, and get unfiltered about what it takes to be your own boss. This is the Entreprenista podcast, presented by Socialfly.
It's the best business meeting you'll ever have, with must-hear real-life looks at how leading women in business are getting it done
and what it takes to build and grow a successful company. It's beyond the gram,
with no filters,
no limits, and plenty of surprises. Check out all our latest episodes at entreprenistapodcast.com.
You know, you're changing a lot of the way that's traditionally, you know, timelines and things like that. You mentioned as you're expanding to D2C to more wholesale channels, that's been a challenge. What are the lessons learned, and how are other brands even learning from this? Or like retailers, tell us about the process.
Oh, I have so many feelings on distribution. So there's a challenge in general in the industry in D2C brands of how do you scale in a world where many brands started back when Facebook ads were free,
right?
Not free, but they were really underpriced media. And now you have, you know, now it's much more competitive and markets are just very efficient, as they always are. And so it's much more challenging to acquire that customer, you know, especially at a price point like ours, which was everything's $30 and under. Mm-hmm. And there's another layer of that too, which is that beauty, and I'm sure y'all have talked about this before, for an industry like fashion, e-com really solves a lot of friction. It's not that fun to go to the store and try on a million things. It can be fun, but for the most part, it's kind of a hassle. Whereas with beauty, there is a really sensorial, wonderful, ceremonial experience around discovering it. And it can be a fun thing you do with your friends. It can be something that's very relaxing. And so I think that is the big macro reason that digital beauty is still such a small part of the industry, so much smaller than other – as a percentage than other industries. I think it's still around 10%. And I don't know that, you know, getting better technology or better customer experience is going to – it'll change it because there's a new customer that just is so digitally innate. But I also don't think that it's going to be it's not going to have the same like sea change as an industry like fashion. Mm-hmm. So that said, we've always known that we'd have to partner with great retailers in order to touch all of these customers that are so amazing and incredible. And that's where they're shopping for beauty for the most part, right? Like that's what the data is telling us. So We knew we'd have to do that. We were a company, you know, built off of the back of like an e-com business. And so we had very strong ideals about the way we do things and the way we produce and the way that mm-hmm. we test and the way we get customer feedback. And it was funny, we kind of learned the beauty business backwards. Mm-hmm. So I think that was a huge challenge for our company, was to learn how to plan for wholesale partnerships. It was to learn how to really manage those partnerships, to understand what to expect. And we've been very lucky. We're, you know, have great partnerships with some of the best companies in the world. But I also think that it will be interesting in the future to see how they change mm-hmm. their planning processes, because they too want to be inventory light. They right. also want to turn product quickly. They want to be on the forefront of what's happening. And I think the way that they've approached it in the past is to really make the brand the warehouse, or make the brand shoulder all of the inventory risk.
Right.
But as things become faster and faster, I'll probably be dragged out and beaten for this statement, and like the beauty mafia will come and get me. But I think there's probably a little bit of a margin squeeze that's going to happen in the industry, because we're just looking at a quicker supply chain, which mm-hmm. is going to cost a little bit more.
Right.
And in order to be on the forefront, we're going to have to change the way that we maybe look at acquisition and look at cost of good. And so, yeah, that is probably not music to anyone's ears, because beauty is like that golden industry of like huge 90% margins.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think Marcia Kilgore, you know, is like thinking about it differently, right? I don't know the margins of the business, but like it is a traditionally very high margin business.
Yes.
But there is value to be given back. So on that note, though, so then, you know, the core of the brand is the consumer insights OG. You know, you can still maintain a lot of that. Like, are you thinking about your testing and scale in different ways across channels? And how do you think about exclusives and things like that?
Totally. One of the big challenges was what do we do now that we've been so addicted to being able to launch, test, pivot with these products? That isn't a luxury you have when you go into a big retailer. Mm-hmm. Especially in a big way, because every change could have hundreds of thousands of dollars of consequences as you shift the product in and out. So we've been very mindful of keeping this like positive feedback loop of really going fast to market with our .com, making sure that we're testing. We do have two freestanding stores of our mm-hmm. own. One is in New
York.
They
look so fun, by the way.
They're so fun. You have to come see them. They're like little wonderlands of beauty. But they're great places too, where our product team can sit and watch people actually interact with the product. Mm-hmm. So those have been invaluable to the development. And we still have lots to learn there. We really are learning. Like I said, we're like an e-com company, really learning to work within the wholesale world, how to tell stories within the wholesale world, how to create great customer relationships in the wholesale world where you can't talk directly to the customer. And so what we've done is we've really focused a lot of our fast market on making sure that we test, understanding what it's going to look like in store still, but having sort of a benchmark for a product to exceed before we bring it into a wholesale partnership. Mm-hmm. Now, that can be kind of challenging for our wholesale partners, because I think they sometimes mistakenly believe that they have to be the first to get something. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't really benefit them to have a product that the customer doesn't love. And inevitably, you're going to have products that come out that aren't going to be the winners. So making sure that we have that and then we invest in that means that their space in their store is just that much more – their precious real estate is that much more productive, because we already know that the customer wants that. Mm-hmm. So it's been there's a little bit of like education on both sides. Actually, there's a lot of education on our side. Mm-hmm. But also us kind of talking through what that's going to mean for them. So, and I think that's like a very interesting changing landscape too. And I think more and more beauty companies will have some of their own stores, again, to keep testing and keep mm-hmm. understanding, but also how that will abstract into their wholesale partnerships will be interesting.
And what do you see as the next evolution for the brand? It's grown so fast and you're expanding into all these different channels.
Yeah.
What's next?
So when we first launched, we were really focused on that beginning relationship with the customer, and like hitting her over the head with something joyful. And it was great, but there was a lot of opportunity for us to really dive deeper into that partnership and understand kind of what we wanted her journey to be with the brand long term. So what we've done is we've really invested this past year on team and technology and just like operationally focusing on understanding what are the products that become part of her, the diaspora of her everyday. Like, what are the things that make her, that she just can't live without over and over again? Not just the stuff that she collects and throws in a drawer because it's like really fun and cute, but the things that really make her happy day in and day out. And so we've started to invest a lot more in some of our longer lead supply chain and understanding what are those like skincare hybrids that we can bring to the table. Our customer keeps telling us that she wants a little bit of makeup in her skincare and a little bit of skincare in her makeup. So as we start to really branch into that part of the business, we are thinking a lot about how do we bring that joyful element to something that is really like a solution for her every day. And that's where we've seen our repeat rates almost doubled in a year. And I would like to say it's just because the team has been better at reaching out, but I actually think it's really product driven. Right. It's about, you know, she loves our priming moisturizer. She loves our tinted moisturizer. And that has sunscreen. That was a long development timeline. Still shorter than I think a lot of our competitors, just because we're able to push a lot of the operational stuff through faster.
It's so true on the organization. I've actually looked into this like a lot. And it's funny, like one of our clients, I won't say who it is, but they're like, why is all our stuff over there at manufacturer?
Yeah.
And all these other ones are here for a fast fashion brand. He's like, oh yeah, just because they have a better deadline. I'm like, that's it. You know? Yep. So a lot of it is a cultural internal timelines, and you know, it's pretty fascinating.
Yeah. I think a lot of brands have maybe they've used it to their advantage from a marketing standpoint, mm-hmm. to say like, we spent years developing this product. If you spend time in a lab, a shade match can take an hour, or you could spend 6 months mm-hmm. working on something. But typically it's kind of somewhere at the tactical part of
right.
really editing the formula, unless you're doing medical actives, like sure. stuff that you need a prescription for, which is in the drug world. For most of the stuff that's not a drug.
Well, there's like enough institutional knowledge, right? And like yes. what works and what doesn't.
Yes. So, yeah. And there's so much that we can still bring to the table. There's so many ways to improve upon what is out there, but we're not necessarily, and most brands, in fact, I think 99% of brands are just not starting from zero. You're starting from a place of like, we know that this, you know, we know that hyaluronic acid is great, and it's really great, and our customer really wants products that have that in it. So let's start with a base that we know we can add a lot of hyaluronic acid to. Our customer is a little bit younger, so she's thinking about, you know, we don't necessarily want to be in the anti-acne space, but we maybe want to have a tiny bit of salicylic acid in our moisturizers because we know that cell turnover is something that she's thinking about. And, you know, that might be a slightly more of a problem for her than someone a little bit older. So I think really what brands are trying to say when they say we took 2 years to develop this, a lot of times it's we took 2 years to get this to market. And I think operationally we're able to be a lot quicker. Now, also factories too, some of the best factories do have long leads and long timelines, but they're changing as well. They're also prioritizing people who demand fast, you know, who demand things a little bit faster. And there's been a new surge in new factories. There's been a lot of like interesting operational talent that's really started. You're starting to see like the average age of the factory owner become a little bit younger too. Mm-hmm. It used to be almost exclusively 70-year-old dudes. But it seems to be shifting a bit. And I think that there's more of an emphasis on, you know, because there has to be. It's kind of a new day.
Amazing.
So next up, we're going to get to know Natalie at a much more personal level while we hit the can.
Makeup in Shanghai is the only B2B event in Shanghai with global makeup and skincare offers from ingredients, formulation, design, packaging, accessories, and full-service suppliers, along with workshops and conferences by top experts of the industry. The next edition, April 8th and 9th, 2020, at the Shanghai Exhibition Center. Whatever your project is, you can find the best contacts there. You can ask for a free badge on the website makeup-in-shanghai.com.
And now, it's Hitting the Pan.
So now we're going to hit the pan and get to know Natalie at a much more personal level. To see who goes first, I'm going to take a spin at this lawn chair. And it lands on April.
All right. So tell us a little bit about where you're from and how you said you were fairly new to the beauty industry with this brand, and how you got, you transitioned from your previous life into this one.
So I am, and by the way, I love the word hit the pan. That's so great.
I know.
I love that term.
Yep. That's what everyone wants. Every beauty manufacturer wants people to hit the pan eventually.
Totally.
Right?
Totally. So I grew up in the Southeast. I grew up in Savannah, Georgia.
Savannah.
It is great.
A beautiful city.
It's awesome. Most of my extended family is still there. It's definitely a lot cooler. I think when I was younger, it was like, maybe it was just me. I couldn't wait to
get out of town.
But by way of South Florida, we actually moved when I was in high school. But I think that some of that has like influenced the way that I think about our customer, and how accessibility has always been built into the product, because there just really wasn't that much in the towns that I grew up in. There weren't a ton of options.
Right.
So we always wanted to be really accessibly priced, and we always wanted to be, available in the easiest, most frictionless way.
Got it. That's awesome. And how did you, what was the industry you started in?
I started my career in finance, and then I always joke that like, it was great because I worked for all of these really powerful women at the top. And then I'm like, no, just kidding. there were very few women I could look up to in that industry. Just because I think there's still like a major problem there with diversity, especially at the top. And so I kind of knew that I wanted to become an entrepreneur. And after about 5 years, I started a company with two other business partners that was in brand licensing, and we were bringing kind of management consulting to the fashion and beauty industry. So my specialty was like the financial structuring, and because I had worked in a consumer group, I kind of knew a little bit about that, and I could help a lot of like younger brands or brands that were kind of trying to reinvent themselves. Mm-hmm. And I did that for 5 years, and I left. I had done a beauty. I'd worked with some manufacturers in the beauty space, and we'd help them find some really great brands to work with. But I was like really passionate about how technology was going to change the way the consumer was behaving. So I consulted for, I think, a year, which was a scary year. It was like a very, because I gave up my, I gave up my like regular income and started to really like hack into my savings in order to, start building what would become WinkyLux. So that was like a terrifying thing, but was great. And for the first 2 years of the business, we bootstrapped. We actually didn't raise capital until we were 2 years old, or almost 2 years old.
When you decided to raise capital, did you already pivot into the product business, or were you still in the tech business?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we really were only in we were really only building the platform, luckily, and I really have to give my business partner all the credit for this, because I think he had a great lens being from completely outside the industry. He was in the consumer electronics business, which is a great learning ground for, or a training ground for,
being in a very fast-paced market. It's a really low margin, really fast mm-hmm. business, like high volumes. And so he really was like, we should start talking to people about this because you may have an instinct about it, but we should check this with data. So we really worked on it for probably only about 4 months. Mm-hmm. And then as we got the beta running, we were lucky enough to have dived in and really seen that it wasn't that incredible.
Right, right. No, but I mean, I think that's one of the most important things of entrepreneurship, like yeah. failing fast and moving on quickly. I mean, it's not a yes. fail, but like being able to let go.
Yeah.
I think investors, appreciate that.
Totally.
And it's also your life. It's like your own personal investment. So.
Absolutely. Especially at that point in time yeah. where I was watching I was living in New York City and watching, my rent bang into my savings every month.
Been there. And it's
like, you start to get that sick feeling of like, how am I going to do this? But we were already deep in the product space mm-hmm. and we'd actually launched the Flower Bomb by then. And so we had some traction. But that also wasn't that easy of a process. Like beauty it's now become a lot more popular because I think just consumer has had it kind of, it's always had its like waves of popularity within the VC space. But again, there's plenty of data. Like there's just not that many partners, female partners in VC firms.
Right.
Very, very few. And oftentimes when there are, sometimes they may not have as big of a voice at the table or they may have a smaller fund. Definitely, the majority of the control is still in the hands of kind of like blue vest wearing guys. And look, we have those people on our cap table too, and we love them. And we have some really great male investors, but it definitely was, I think it's a little bit more of a challenge when you're in investors would come to our office and they would be in like a pink world of neon signs and flowers and, they would kind of get it, but they'd also think it'd be kind of weird, it wasn't something that they could necessarily relate to. So I think that was a challenge, but it definitely made all of us like battle tested all of us.
Mm-hmm. Cool. So take one more spin. And it lands on me. So what personally brings you joy? What makes you happy?
Oh, I really love design. I think that I was drawn towards industries like finance because I came from a really middle-class background, and that was like a way for me to kind of get out of like a smaller town and to maybe do things that were more glamorous. But I think if I had had like any choice, I would have really – and I'm glad my life has turned out the way I wanted it to. And I'm really glad I have a lot of like tactical business knowledge to bring to the table. But I think I would have been like a designer, like a graphic artist or something. Like I really love particularly the way spaces make people feel. So – that brings me a lot of happiness. I love walking into a space and like having it evoke some sort of emotion for me. So yeah, I would say design, both like visual graphic design and also like interiors, just what they mean to people.
Cool. So. Amazing. I guess it like lifts your mood, right?
Yeah. I totally recommend this book called Joyful by Ingrid Lee that talks a lot about how certain colors.
Is she the aesthetics of joy person?
Yes.
I love her.
Yeah, she's so great. I'm like fangirling hardcore.
I sent that TED talk to like everyone.
Yeah. It's and her book is great. The idea that for some reason we fight against this notion that we should have like more beautiful things surrounding us in our day to day. And certainly when you walk into an office that feels very fun, you instantly know it, mm-hmm. right? Like you instantly know that this is a place where you feel comfortable. But why is it that when we walk into most doctor's offices or hospitals or places where,
more joy.
Yeah. Where you're even more vulnerable. Like why aren't we really creating better aesthetic storytelling? Like why aren't we doing things that make people more comfortable and make them happier? I mean, Lord knows we have plenty of stress in our lives.
Yeah.
I think stress levels for young people are at an all-time high, and anxiety for Gen Z, is bananas. And so we're constantly being like
flooded with information and what's the word? There's like a very screamy way of communicating lately. And the more things in our lives that can be wonderful and happy, I think it's like, I think we should acknowledge it as a visceral need, you know, not like a nice to have, but a have to have. Like, we have to have these moments of like just pure happy.
Love that. Love so it. Do you have any final thoughts for our listener? I mean, that was probably a pretty good one. Yeah.
Come to our stores. Come meet our team.
We'll come to the stores so we can be more joyful.
All yes, right. Exactly. Come to our stores and be more. I love to hear from people in the industry. I think it's such a magical, fun industry. It's full of really smart people. And so I love talking to other beauty industry execs and just people who want to get into the beauty industry. And so people can hit me up on Instagram. I don't have a ton of followers, so follow me. Winky Lux does, but I'm so boring.
What's your Instagram?
It's Nat Mac 1. So Natalie Mackey is NatMack1. Okay. But I try to answer most of my DMs. And
amazing.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. It was
thanks
such
for
a delight.
Having me. It's really fun. Awesome.
And April, thanks so much for joining us, obviously.
Thank you, Ken.
And for everyone else, too, thanks so much for listening in and staying through the end. We look forward to seeing you on the next show.
Thank you.
Hugs and kisses.
Thank you.
This has been Beauty is Your Business, produced by Mouth Media Network. Copyright 2019. Keep in touch on Instagram and Facebook at Mouth Media Network and find prior episodes at beautyisyourbusiness.com and wherever the best podcasts are found. Your brand message can be on this show. Email us to find out more at podcast@mouthmedianetwork.com. Thank you for listening.
This is Mouth Media Network. Amplify and connect.